ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Lena Srivastava, a social innovation strategist with over 15 years experience working at the intersection of social action, community-centered design, and interactive storytelling. The founder of Creative Impact and Experience Lab, Lena is also co-creator of the My City Project, the lead on the Transformational Change Leadership Storytelling Project, and has been involved in engagement campaigns for Oscar-winning and Emmy-nominated documentaries. Lena, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you explain for listeners who aren't familiar what the Creative Impact and Experience Lab is and what inspired you to found it, 10 years ago?
Sure. So the name is new. It's about 2 years old. I have been running my company for 10 years, 8 years of which it didn't actually even have a name. But yeah, it was interesting. And I finally sort of, you know, the saying that the cobbler's children never have shoes, I was like, I should probably have a name myself as well.
So, no branding.
There you go. Exactly. So I came by the name. It was actually sort of given to me by someone I was working with at the time, a man named Scott Smith and his wife, Susan Cox Smith, who they run Changist. And we were sort of thinking through what on the landscape, what is needed in terms of the confluence between innovation, human rights, international development, social change, futurism, all these different sort of trends and fields that were sort of mashing up and coming together over the last 10 years. And we came up with the name, the Creative Impact and Experience Lab, CL, which also means sky. And it's sort of at the root of my work has always been in narrative and storytelling and leveraging culture for rights and development. And I added 10 years ago, I sort of added social innovation and design thinking to that mix. And I founded my company 10 years ago to start exploring all of those fields and how they actually can together catalyze social transformation or social change, primarily from and by communities themselves. So this is how I sort of came to start the company and then rebranded it the Creative Impact and Experience Lab. But it's always about communities. It's always about people who themselves are making change.
What are some of your current projects? What are you working on currently?
So at the moment, I just released a project a couple of weeks ago called Transformational Change Leadership. It's a pretty wonky name, but it was given to me. That is exactly what it says. It's looking at leadership and the concept of leadership and how you catalyze transformational change. The term transformational change means something that transforms a community or a society from one state to a more positive and desired state, taking into account everyone, taking into account the well-being of all. And I was given a leadership grant from the Rockefeller Foundation about 3 years ago, and have spent the last 3 years sort of studying and talking to communities and talking to leaders in communities about their process, about how they make change, and started thinking about how you tell that story. So we just released a rather comprehensive website. It's, you know, as far as you can get on the web, it's fairly analog. It's text and image only, but we look at how you catalyze transformational change in your own community and what are the principles, what's the process of leadership that it takes to get there. So that's a pretty big project right now.
How is that, or is that, I would think it would be, culturally bounded, because sort of how, you know, openness to change and things like that, how does the site help people understand how to adjust? Is it targeting only within America? Is it global? Is it targeting communities expressly outside of the United States? And how do you deal with that cultural dimension?
Sure. So it's global. It's coming out of discussions around global development and human rights. That is, it's an international construct. It doesn't except out the United States or Canada. There are projects and organizations that we've profiled. We've profiled to launch, we've profiled 28 different organizations and 9 emerging leaders, and we'll be adding to it, but it's international. And everything is, it's a great question, because everything is culturally dependent. And the process as we've laid it out, the process of leadership, and we're very specific, it's a process. Leadership, the way we're defining it, is leadership is a process. It doesn't necessarily reside in a person, right? It's sort of moving away from that single individual hero construct. But you find commonalities, because when you're looking at leadership and looking at change as a community-based process, there are commonalities, even though there are sort of cultural contexts. And one of the arguments is that most transformational change leaders are successful or confront the issues that they're dealing with because they're very aware of and know how to navigate their own cultural context. That's sort of answering your question in two ways. One is that leadership is very much dependent on the cultural context in which you find yourself. And so different efforts are going to look different depending on where you are or what the cultural context is. And then the second thing is that the leaders we profiled and the ones who sort of fit this paradigm know how to navigate that and know how to leverage it.
Right. In the United States, certainly there's a lot about millennials and how they're motivated by authentic connection stories, desire to make real change. But how much is that? Well, two questions, actually. One is, are some of those, would you believe, or do you, have you seen that cohort behaves similarly globally, or is this really an American, European, first world phenomenon due to sort of prolonged adolescence? And also, is this, well, I know, I'm a little judgy there, but it's true. Anyway, but, and have you also, is it real activism, or is it sort of social hashtag activism where it's like the Kony stuff, or where I've clicked something and then I'm on to the next and it really doesn't change anything?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's both. So I'll answer the first question that you asked about whether it's an American or North American phenomenon. No, I think sort of millennial culture, I've traveled quite a bit, and it's funny because I'm a proud Gen Xer, but I was on a panel. There you go. I know we're fabulous, but so are millennials in a very different way. And it was interesting. I was giving a series of talks in South Africa, primarily through the embassy, the American embassy there, and they put me on a panel called. So it was about millennials. And I was like, guys, you have my passport. You know I'm not a millennial. They're like, oh, we didn't actually check. But you know, sort of bring your. I'm like, bring your perspective as a Gen Xer on this question. And I both spoke about what it felt like to be a Gen Xer working in sort of, you know, in and among millennials who are far more marketed to and far more catered to in digital circles, but also was listening because most of the panel and most of the audience were South African millennials. And it was fascinating because the conversation was so different than conversations I've had with millennials in the United States. There were commonalities for sure, but there was a sort of, and this is going to sound slightly judgy, so forgive me, but there was an authenticity to the discussion in South Africa because they are so close. I mean, it's so close in time to the end of apartheid. They are the born free generation. And they're dealing with things in sort of, even though they're using primarily digital tools, there is a connection between the digital activism and real world activity. And there was sort of this grittiness and this authenticity and this real understanding of what action is and activism is. There were, you know, sort of certainly problems. There was, you know, what I saw as a Gen Xer, I was like, oh, there was a real rejection of what had come before. And that's what I find also in the US a little bit is a rejection of what's come before, or a lack of knowledge. Like I was talking to a couple of amazing millennial sort of campaigners and they're looking at civic engagement, but sort of we sat down to talk about the differences in the way we did activism based on our age demographic. And the attitude, and I've heard this from other people before, was that we Gen Xers didn't have to deal with what they had to deal with. And we didn't really, because we were sandwiched in between civil rights and, you know, and what they're dealing with. And I was like, no. I mean, the 80s, 90s, you know, early 2000s, we were dealing with quite a bit, like, you know, things like, you know, like really.
Like recession, you know? Cold War.
Yeah, or like, you know, Iran-Contra. And I brought up the example of ACT UP, that's sort of where I learned.
Right, AIDS, hello.
Yeah, amazing, amazing stuff. And they had never heard of ACT UP. And I was like, okay, this is a real. So ACT UP is actually on the TCL project that we just released about leadership and mobilization. And I use ACT UP as an example because their leadership, their tactics, their activities are amazing. And really, we need to sort of follow them. And I think a lot of what ACT UP has done is a beautiful blueprint for sort of the Trump era. And so I think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, this sort of blindness, the sort of hungry naivete of youth, if you will. I mean, every generation has that, don't they? I mean, there was a documentary I saw about Richard Holbrooke, and he was incredibly frustrated with Obama because he wanted to talk about the lessons from Vietnam and apply them to Afghanistan. And Obama wasn't particularly interested in listening to these very relevant things from somebody who lived through it. And, you know, so this is at the highest level with very bright people not wanting to have that old lesson, that old way brought into thinking, you know, that. And even just yesterday I was speaking to Marcella Karp, and she was talking about third wave feminism and how young women today are unaware about some of the journeys that have happened prior. And it's sometimes it's like, oh, you will age, you will learn. It will come to you as well. So is it something that this is just a perpetual challenge?
I think it's both. I mean, that's why I try not to be too, you know, too bitter or too complainy about millennials, because I feel like, you know, probably in my earlier days, there was a sort of a rejection of the past, perhaps. Maybe not so much. I think we did grow up still pretty close to at least Vietnam, and it was part of our social consciousness to a certain extent. But I do think that it's perpetual. Like we need to carve our own paths. I think it's sort of up to us to not say, oh, you'll learn. I think it's up to us to create, you know, sort of like bridges of dialogue to say, oh, no, we've done this, and we do have some wisdom to impart. And by the way, we're still learning, right? Like we don't have all the answers, but we've seen how we've adapted. And I think, you know, that's something that I've tried to bury, sort of unearth from the leadership work that I've been lately doing, is that there is a sense of evolution that we keep learning throughout our lives, and we just keep gathering wisdom as we go. But then we also know how much we don't know, you know, that old adage. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we have to keep in mind when we talk, because there are some incredible millennial activists, incredible millennial creators. And so I don't want to paint like an entire generation or entire demographic with the same brush. Right. So there is.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Kony 2012 was a massive disaster in many, many ways. Besides just being poverty porn, it was also just not, I don't know what ultimately the impact was. Like, we can talk about that quite a bit. But there are, you know, when you look at, there are valid criticisms, but you look at sort of the Me Too movement, which is cross-generation. You look at, you know, sort of Black Lives Matter, which is, you know, born originally out of a hashtag and sort of a naming and framing, sort of claiming power through that. And that's, you know, particularly, I think, millennial construct, even if not everybody's millennial. You know, so I think that there's a discussion to be had about what techniques work, you know, and to me, it always comes back to how grounded is it in sort of the most affected communities, and how much are they taking power or taking sort of ownership over the way either a campaign's constructed or a project is designed or an organization is created, or, you know, how much is that happening? And I think that's the better question than, you know, what demographic are we?
So I guess I want to drill down or distill a bit. So if we're talking about converting a level of online engagement to real robust real world engagement, are you saying that it really has to do with the the resonance in the community you're targeting of the messaging, the authenticity of the messaging, and the allowing of that community to actually own that message themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's a crucial part. A long time ago, probably three or four years ago now, at the height of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign,
right,
I wrote a piece called Unhashtagable, which was like sort of looking at like what can you hashtag? And this is all saying that I do campaign work very rarely. Most of my work is deeply grounded in sort of participatory narrative and, you know, working with community and sort of more of a, there's more design constructs and narrative and advocacy stuff that I do. And every once in a while I'll work on a campaign. In fact, we're in the planning stages of launching a campaign called Welcoming Migrants, which is sort of pushing back on the xenophobic framings that have been since, you know, sort of, you know, the 2016 elections. I mean, the tenor of the discourse around migrants, regardless of where they are, and just we're taping this the day after the shithole comments, right? So, yeah, it's just the rhetoric has become extremely toxic, and there has been a real, it's been difficult for a long time, but sort of this sort of post 2016 election environment has become extremely toxic to migrants and to immigrants. So we're building a campaign around that, and it is a traditional sort of social media campaign, trying to sort of create more, sort of shift the narrative to something a little more positive. So, I mean, having said that, campaign work isn't necessarily my forte as much as the narrative and the design work is. But I did write this piece called Unhashtagable because I was trying to figure out what is hashtag activism and what is not. And right, I had, at that point, had, you know, sort of contrasted Bring Back Our Girls, which was a locally created hashtag. It was created in Nigeria, and it was sort of, but then it was sort of hijacked, right? It was hijacked by the West. And it was used to raise money for some Western organizations and such. And it really, people took control away from community. When it went back to community, it became much more successful, right? When people lost interest. And, you know, and I remember having conversations around that time with people who said, well, I just, you know, in the West, who said, I just want to join. I just want to be able to do something. And I was like, but the messaging is absolutely, it's wrong. I mean, it's been hijacked away from local organizations and people actually doing the work and actually, you know, liaising with the community and the families of these girls who've gone missing. It's lost a lot. To me, it's lost community resonance. And I was, there was pushback. I got pushback on that. And I still think I'm right, you know, because when you look at the ultimate impact of that work, it is sort of local. This is not to say that everything needs to be hyper local. I think that there's a place for international connection and international anywhere from outrage to action. You know, I think that there's definitely a place, but I think when you start hijacking people's narratives or people's work and then using it for your own ends, that's when it becomes toxic, or it sort of dissipates into slacktivism. So I think there are ways to do it.
Well, I think you used a phrase earlier in our conversation. You said poverty porn. And actually, Joe Hall, who is the founder of Ghetto Film School, also referred to poverty porn. And I think that is an interesting sort of danger area, if you will, when you have these sort of international, you know, people are moved initially by an event that's international, and yet they almost want to take it here, you know, white man's burden it, you know, here, let us do this for you because we know so much better than you. And is that in the work that you're doing even, I mean, you are from here and, you know, do you have to surrender at a certain point to the local and to the, you know, you lead the way? Or I guess I'm going in many different directions.
Yeah,
there,
no. So let me parse some of that out. So yes, I mean, I try to, I mean, that's one of the reasons that the term design thinking has fallen out of favor a little bit because there is a sort of, for a lot of reasons, so we won't get into that, but I still like it and I still use it sometimes because the notion of putting the community at the center, like community-centered design, is really crucial, I think, in the way we think through how we make change. And yes, there's a certain giving up of control that I think has to be done when you're coming from a Western construct into a community that has been sort of formally colonized or, you know, has been exploited, and you have to take some of your assumptions out of the mix. But this is true also, like, you know, if I haven't had the honor of working yet in Appalachia, but if that were the case, I would have to take my New Yorker stuff off, you know, like just take it and leave it and listen. Having said that, there is sort of a level of skill and knowledge and expertise that I bring, and I have to make sure that I bring that. It, like, you can't sit there like a lump, right? you're contributing, and so you're basically partnering with a community to sort of make the community, give it its own avenues to make change, understanding that sometimes the community itself can be the obstacle, right? Like when you're thinking about things like gender constructs or, you know, sort of power constructs, you have to be very careful about understanding. You have to understand, like, sort of the culture in which you find yourself. And, you know, as someone who is an American born here, but comes from sort of an Eastern heritage, I have a certain amount of facility with understanding how to navigate certain cultures. But yeah, I willingly usually give up control when I'm working with other people to say, you know, what is it that this community is sort of asking for, and how do I bring my knowledge to bear on what you're trying to do? But poverty porn it happens all the time. And we haven't necessarily grappled with, I see discussions happening now. I think the poverty porn discussion has been happening for a good at least 10 to 15 years with that term attached. And it's been happening primarily in aid and development circles and looking at marketing discussions. It's only recently that I've been seeing it in sort of storytelling or like transmedia and storytelling and documentary and those kinds of circles. I'd seen that less, and it's sort of starting to ramp up. But there still is a notion of like who gets to tell the story? You know, that question of who gets to tell the story, who has ownership, who has input. I think that argument is being made more and more, but it hasn't reached, I think, too far into it. And you still see it in the aid and development industry. You still see, you know, ads or marketing campaigns or fundraising campaigns where you just want to grow, and you're like, oh my God, who thought that was a good idea? And there's an organization out of Norway called Radiaid, which actually has sort of they have awards, and they look at sort of the campaigns from the past year and basically rate them in terms of what's poverty porn, what's not. It's a really interesting organization. A couple of years ago, I think four or five years ago, I had co-founded a community with Linda Raftree, who is an aid and development and participatory media analyst as well, who's now doing a lot of work on data privacy and open systems and such. And so she and I have co-founded this community called Regarding Humanity, which we haven't really paid enough attention to in the last year. You know, we probably should revive it. But it's looking at agency and representation in humanitarian storytelling and design. So we did a lot of work 4 or 5 years ago looking at poverty porn, looking at what works, what kind of narrative works in the realm of aid, development, human rights, in the documentary industry, and, you know, and sort of in journalism, like what's good, what is poverty porn. So we laid some of that foundation, I think, a few years ago. I still use a lot of those arguments because you're still seeing narrative that is controlled by people outside of a community. And so it doesn't resonate. And sometimes it's just downright condescending.
Right. Of course. We actually have run through our time with you, which, you know, I could talk to you for hours. It's really fascinating stuff and great work around building the process of leadership and change, transformational change. Really impressive. So thank you so much for spending the time with us today. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate being on your program. Thank you so much.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest,
Lena Srivastava.
And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.